computer's online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. Today we're speaking to Jim DiEugenio, author and producer of some good stuff with Oliver Stone. Everybody knows who he is. So hello, Jim.
How you doing, Len?
Good. Thank you for making time tonight. We got a couple things to talk about. We haven't taken questions for a while. You've got some new articles up at Kennedy's and King. We can get into that. And anything else you want to bring up? Anything that?
Well, I think it's important to bring up what happened in the United States. Donald Trump won the election, and he won it going away. He made a lot of the pundits look kind of silly, but against all the Hollywood liberal community, Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro.
Oh, De Niro especially, right?
Yeah. Robert De Niro, Beyonce, Jennifer Lopez, Bruce Springsteen.
Don't forget Taylor Swift, right?
Taylor Swift, yeah. Right. Okay. The Hollywood musical, the combination Hollywood musical power elite. He did it, you know, with Tucker Carlson. Okay, and Elon Musk, okay, and Megyn Kelly, I guess. You could have
and Joe Rogan.
Add her in.
Joe Rogan.
And Joe Rogan, right.
And he had Vax on a couple of days earlier. And Theo Vaughn, and here's the problem. Some people really don't like Trump because of his abrasive nature, and I can just accept that. You know, yeah, I always thought of him kind of as a con man real estate guy. You know, when you go to buy a used car and you shake somebody's hands, you've got to count your fingers kind of thing. But the thing that turned it around for me that I started giving him empathy was when I found out that the FBI had planted people in the January 6th thing, and they had people dressed as Trump supporters and egging them on. And that's like an agent provocateur. And I thought, what business does the FBI do with that? And then I went back and I thought about, well, the Russiagate, the whole thing that he's a Putin puppet. I started, and then What's that dossier? The Steele dossier, right? And you go, that's
right, the Steele dossier
by Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And I start adding up how many things were attacking Trump, never mind on his accomplishments. We could debate that. And then the other side of the coin was, well, what were the accomplishments of Kamala, whatever, right? And I started thinking they ran her. And they kind of kicked RFK out of there. Tulsi Gabbard quit. It's become a mockery. And I wrote to somebody. I said, you know, it's almost as if it's on purpose. It's not by accident that they ran such a bad candidate. And, you know, that's another discussion. But I think, and my just two cents were, that people that may not have liked Trump, again, like they didn't like Hillary, they just thought, I don't want Kamala Harris, you know, standing there looking like a dummy, laughing and meeting world leaders and saying that she represents America. Man, people are upset today. People, there's a lot of like, wah. And I'm Canadian, so it doesn't bug me either way, you know. Like somebody said, well, if Kamala wins, she's inheriting like $35 trillion debt. What are they going to do? BRICS has pulled the plug on the U.S. paper dollar. I mean, it's bad news. And if Trump wins, he inherits that mess as well. So
well, you know what you just said about BRICS. See, I don't think very many people want to admit this, but I believe it's true. I believe that Biden's foreign policy was very bad. I believe that Biden was a cold warrior, and he was pretty close to being a neocon. Okay, and that was the problem I felt with Hillary Clinton also, that she was a neocon. For all intents and purposes, she was a neocon in her foreign policy. Now, her domestic policy would have been better than Trump, but she was a neocon. Now, Biden gets in there, and what does he do? He refuses to negotiate over Ukraine, along with his buddies in England and Merkel in Germany.
And Victoria Nuland, right?
Oh, well, let's not even talk about her. I mean, Victoria, the fact that Biden kept her in the administration after what she did previously, I mean, there's no excuse for that. Victoria Nuland was a female Frankenstein. I mean, she was a dyed-in-the-wool, triple-distilled neocon all the way down to her roots. And so Merkel, you know, from Germany, she admitted that they were playing around with Putin, that they really never took Minsk I or Minsk II, the two truces that he was going to arrange, seriously. They were just delaying so they could supply weapons to Zelensky. She admitted that. And then when Zelensky decided to negotiate, Boris Johnson goes over there and tells him, call it off. And this is when they're on the verge of signing a peace treaty. Okay, so exactly what is the point of all this blood and treasure being spent in the Ukraine for all these years now? I don't understand it at all. If you can get a peace treaty, get a peace treaty. All right, so we've spent, $100 billion now? I think it's more than that by now, on this war that has cost, the figures I have and the guys I listen to on this, I don't know who you listen to, but I listen to McGregor and I listen to Scott Ritter. Is that who you listen to?
Oh, yeah. And I found somebody even better. There's Jeffrey Sachs. Mike Benz is a former State Department official that's been blowing the whistle on everything. I haven't heard such truth-telling since, you know, Fletcher Prouty.
What's his name again?
Mike, B-E-N-Z, Benz.
Mike Ben.
Right.
I never heard of this guy.
I'll send you a link. It'll blow your mind. Because he's been on Tucker, he's been on Jimmy Dore, he's been on several, and he just knows the Ukraine story inside out, and you shake your head. You go, how the hell are these, you know, nobody votes on the money. They just decide that they're going to cause this war that will get Russia into it, they'll bankrupt them, and then they'll have to admit Ukraine to the NATO. And then all of Europe will be against Russia, and then they'll bet, you know. Let me just send you a link. I'll even put it on the show.
Okay, good. Thanks. I really appreciate listening to this guy. Now, the other thing, of course, that I think Biden's been a failure on is this whole thing with Israel and the Middle East. I mean, in my opinion, this has been a debacle. And he's never threatened to pull the plug. You know, like JFK threatened to pull the plug even when there wasn't a war going on. Okay, just to stop them from finishing Dimona. But Biden, I believe, never really seriously threatened to pull the plug. I mean, the worst that Biden did was no more 2,000-pound bombs. Okay, in other words, we'll give you 1,000-pound bombs. We'll give you 1,500-pound, no more 2,000-pound bombs. And so this has now gone on now for, over a year now? And Israel has expanded the war. They've expanded the war now into Lebanon and to Iran. And I don't know what information you're getting. The information I'm getting is that Hezbollah has more or less neutralized any Israeli advance into Lebanon. They've done very well. It's not like the IDF used to be. Everybody used to think the IDF was sort of like the German Wehrmacht. Okay, it was just overpowering. That's not how it's turning out this time, according to my sources. Hezbollah has 100,000 troops, very well organized, and they've stymied any Israeli advance. Now, I don't know if you've heard this, but I've heard it, that some of the Israeli troops refused to go. Did you ever hear that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, because it's so bad.
It's so bad, though. I'll tell you. My opinion is, I think that Israel threatened to reveal something about 9/11, I'm not ready to articulate that here right now, but I just think, how can they just bully America like that? They say, you either we set up this whole thing where we gave them the weapons so they could make a little attack on us, and now we're fighting back like a tidal wave, just like America went into Afghanistan and Iraq and all that. And now you guys shut up. It's our turn. We're going to do this.
And then you have this thing with Iran. I did some homework on the first of all, Trump is so wrong when he says that Trump just runs off at the mouth. I don't think he understands what he's saying most of the time. But he said somehow that when the United States went ahead and unfroze Iranian assets, that's when it developed this missile arsenal. That's not true at all. Iran started building its missile arsenal when it was attacked by Iraq, okay, in the 1980s. And they knew they couldn't get any help from the United States. And so they had to go elsewhere. And where did they go? They went eastward, China and Russia. And they began to build three generations of missiles based on those designs, particular help from China. And by the way, this is always what JFK used to say. You know, he always used to say, look, we can outbid the Russians. We don't have to be enemies with everybody there. We can compete with the Russians. So what happened is the United States got on the wrong side of history. They backed the Iraqis because of what happened with the hostage crisis in Iran. And that's when Iran began to build their missile arsenal with help from China and also Russia. And do you know this? They have 15,000 missiles. They have a top flight staff, okay, that has in their missile headquarters. And they're also starting to buy the latest generation fighter from Russia. And Russia is sending them this fighter in parts so they can learn how to construct it themselves. And they can start building it on their own. And from what I heard, the last attack by Israel, where they used the F-35 American fighter, did not go very well. Because the Russians have also given Iran a really good missile defense system. And so what the Israelis had to do is they had to fire their rockets, you know, from the fighter jets from a distance because they were getting so many planes shot down. Iran has developed a really terrific military. Okay, I mean, the only military I can think in that area that surpasses Iran, and I'm excluding Israel, of course, okay, is Turkey. Okay, that's the only one I believe that surpasses Iran. And I truly believe that Israel has bitten off more than it can chew. And I blame Biden for this. I don't know why he allowed this to happen. You know, they're fighting on three fronts now. They're fighting, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. And I don't think there's any way they can win on those three fronts, on all three fronts. Okay? And so I consider this a real failure of the Biden administration. I know a lot of our people listening to us don't want to hear this, okay, but I believe it's actually accurate, all right, that Biden failed in these two big foreign policy areas. And to hear I couldn't believe this. I don't know how closely you were watching this race from up there in Canada, but they sent Bill Clinton to Michigan. And Bill Clinton started attacking the Palestinians and Hamas for the attack on Israel back in October. And he said some words to the effect that something like 1,200 people were killed and they took 250 hostages. And then somebody in the crowd said, what about the 43,000 dead Palestinians? Okay. This is not the smartest way to run a campaign. And Kamala Harris ended up losing Michigan, okay? You know, so that's, you know, so in addition to all these Hollywood people, Harris had Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton going around the country, and she still lost. And well, by the way, I looked at the tally today,
yeah,
and she lost big.
Oh,
she
yeah.
lost by over 4 million votes, you know?
I read one quote. It said, I haven't seen a man beat a woman so badly since the Paris Olympics.
you know, this is going to be, I mean, people are, one of the most surprising things about this.
Well, hang on, you're forgetting one. You're forgetting one.
What?
The family name of Cheney. Liz Cheney.
Oh, right. Oh, isn't that something?
Yeah. To have a Cheney.
When you have to trot out Republicans, I mean, oh, Jesus. You know, that, what was, I didn't understand what the strategy was behind that. I really didn't. When you start bragging about all the Republicans and you bring in Cheney's daughter, you know the approval rating Dick Cheney had when he left the White House? It was 13%. So, you know, I didn't understand that one at all. The problem Harris had was not so much with the independent and Republican voters. The problem she had was turning out her base. Like, did you see what Bernie Sanders said today on X?
No, I saw his picture, but I didn't read it.
He said it was bad enough when the Democrats lost the working class people in America, but now we're losing the Latino working class along with the African American working class. It's not that so much that we can't compete. It's a matter of them leaving us because we're not offering them anything. When will the Democrats see? And you know, by the way, you remember when Hillary Clinton lost to Trump. Well, they ran a poll on the same day or something like the same week, and they let it. Sanders beat Trump very soundly in that poll.
Yeah, meaning he would have won if they ran him.
Right. Yeah, Sanders would have beaten Trump in 2016. And I believe we would have never heard from Trump again because Sanders beat him by something like 8 points in that poll. So that's the problem with the Democratic Party, I believe. It's become so centrist. I mean, when you're trotting out Liz Cheney on the last 2 days of the campaign, when you're sending Mr. Bill Clinton into Michigan and he says stuff like that, the base didn't turn out for Kamala Harris, you know.
Or they changed their mind.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, there used to be this blue wall in the north, and it was largely made up of what they called the Rust Belt. And this extended from Pennsylvania to Minnesota. Kamala Harris lost Wisconsin. She lost Michigan. She lost Pennsylvania. For all intents and purposes, I believe there is no real blue wall anymore. Because if she would have won those three states, she would have won the election. That would have brought her to 270. Now, she did lose them in close races from some like 1 to 2 points. But that doesn't matter in the Electoral College how much you lose by. You can lose by 10 points. You can lose by 0.2 points. You still lost. Okay, because you don't get anything in the Electoral College. It's a zero-sum game. So she lost those three states. And this really worries me about the Democratic Party. Because if you lose the blue wall and you've essentially forfeited, and this is another thing that bothers me, you've essentially forfeited Texas, Florida, and Georgia, then what do you have? You know, the only thing you really have then is New England and you have the West Coast. That's the real blue wall now. The blue wall is Washington, Oregon, and California. You know, that's what the Democrats can rely upon. But that's not enough to counter the solid South, you know, for the Republican Party. I'm really, you know, and let me, before we get to the Kennedy stuff, let me add one other thing that I don't think has gotten enough notice, but Chris Christie, the former Republican governor, mentioned it last night when the writing was on the wall that Harris was going to lose. He said, first of all, Joe Biden did not commit to two terms, if you remember. And he's right about that. Then he went ahead and decided he was going to run again at the age of 81. All right. And then came the debacle of that debate against Trump. Okay. In which people couldn't believe it. You know, it really did look like he had dementia. All right. And from some people I know, that was the case. They basically hid this, that he was losing his faculties, but they were going to run him anyway. Then Nancy Pelosi came in, and she essentially said, Joe, you got to go. And she more or less chose Kamala Harris. There was no debate about it. There was no, there should have been like a mini decision, because I believe, now, I'm labeling this as belief. I'm not positive. I believe Gavin Newsom would have beaten Trump. If it would have been open and they would have picked the best candidate, I think Gavin Newsom would have beat Trump. He's obviously, as much as I dislike him for vetoing Sirhan's parole, he's obviously the strongest Democrat now, or that we have. And he probably would have won. But they decided to go with the vice president, like this was a chain. I don't think it was such a chain. And they decided to go with her. And, well, at least Pelosi showed up for Kamala Harris's concession speech today, which he delivered from Howard University in Washington. Thanks, Nancy. Real nice move. Okay. And so this is what's happened. And it looks like, I'm not positive, but it looks like the Republicans have scored a trifecta. Can you imagine this? They're going to have the White House. They're going to have the Senate. And it looks like a strong possibility they're going to have the House of Representatives. And on top of that, they already have the Supreme Court. So it's actually a four-bagger. They actually hit a home run. Okay. So this is what it's going to be. You got any room up there in Vancouver, Len? You know? So this is what it's going to be like. I didn't think so.
No, the funny thing is, though, that, you know, many people on Facebook have been writing how bad he is. And I said, yeah, but she lost to him. So how bad, you guys have had to ask yourself, how bad a candidate was she that she lost to Trump, when even little old Bernie may have been? I mean, RFK Jr. Or Tulsi Gabbard. Or there were several other people that I thought were better. Is it Vivek Ramaswamy? I didn't pronounce his name, but anyway, you know, there were several people instead of Trump, but I guess.
See, the Democratic Party has gotten so elitist and so centrist, okay, that Tulsi Gabbard, who I kind of liked when she was a Democrat, you know, she's gone over to the other side now.
Well, I don't blame her. Same with RFK, right, you know?
Yeah, well, with Bobby Kennedy, I mean, somebody should write a whole book about what they did to Bobby Kennedy. I mean, that was, I don't know if you know this, but they, in the LA Times, there were a couple of articles about this. And there, the DNC, remember the DNC that sandbagged Bernie Sanders back in 2016? Well, there was a Get RFK squad inside the DNC. And I'm not going to go through all the things they did to this guy, but believe me, it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad, you know, and they deliberately sandbagged him, and they did a very effective job.
And they won't let it independent. They wouldn't even let on the debate, you know, they wouldn't let a third party, a Green Party, on the debates. So they got nobody else to blame themselves.
I think you mean Jill Stein.
Yeah, I did mean Jill Stein.
Yeah, I actually voted for Jill Stein. Okay, see, in California, is a safe state. It doesn't matter who the Republican is. The Democrat is always going to take what they call the left coast, California, Oregon, and Washington. So I voted for Jill Stein. She didn't get very many people to vote for her, but I was one of them. I consider that my little protest vote, my little way of thumbing my middle finger, you know, at the establishment, you know, because I'm so dissatisfied with. I mean, the Republican Party is out to lunch, okay? You know, it's not matter. They're not for anything. They're just against everything. And the Democratic Party has kind of lost its way. So it's my idea, you know, I can vote for who I want to, living in L.A. And so that's what I did. Joe McBride, who's been on your show a few times, he has a notice up at the Education Forum. Words of the, I think the title is something like The Inevitable Result of the Last, because this article was written about 4 or 5 years ago. Okay, The Inevitable Result of Our Last 56 Years. Okay, and it's pretty interesting the way he equates this with what happened back in 1963. And I believe that's a pretty good argument, that from Kennedy to Johnson was disastrous. Johnson essentially tore the country apart to the point that he couldn't even run in 1968. Well, not only couldn't he run, he couldn't even visit any place except army forts, okay, and naval installations, because he was getting heckled so bad, getting eggs thrown at him, etc., okay, because of what he had done with the Vietnam War. And then, of course, the combination of the student demonstrations and the demonstrations by the NAACP, you know, and King, etc., you know, and seeing those things got the country was just essentially being torn apart. They call 1968, a lot of historians call it, the year of the maelstrom, okay, when, you know, the country was changed forever. And then the Tet Offensive broke out, and that's what finally convinced Johnson that we couldn't win the war, you know, after committing over 500,000 combat troops into Vietnam and Operation Rolling Thunder and all this other stuff. Well, this finally convinced them that we weren't going to win. Okay, the Tet Offensive. All right. And so he decided to finally abdicate, but left.
But you could make the case that he knew that Kennedy was withdrawing and he got killed. So I can't withdraw. They'll kill me.
Well, there's all kinds of reasons that you can put forth for what Johnson did, what he did. One argument is the big backers down in Texas, you know, like the big military industrial complex that was down there. You know, what's Halliburton?
Bell Helicopter.
Okay. Yeah, right. All those things, you know, made him do what he wanted to do. Okay. But the point is, you know, it tore the country apart, you know, and this paved the way, you know, for Nixon, you know, Nixon and Kissinger. And what they did with the Vietnam War, I believe, was probably even worse, you know, than what Johnson did. And those years between Johnson and Nixon, from 1964 to 1975, completely altered the whole political framework of this country. Let me explain very briefly. When William Fulbright, the senator from Arkansas, who Kennedy seriously considered to be his Secretary of State, and in retrospect he should have been, because Dean Rusk wasn't very good. When William Fulbright discovered that Lyndon Johnson had lied to him about the invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965, when Johnson sent in 25,000 Marines to stop the return of Juan Bosch. And let me just show you what a reversal this was. Kennedy backed Juan Bosch, okay, in 1963. He was backing Juan Bosch, who was a democratically elected president. He was overthrown in a military coup, and Kennedy began to freeze all relations with the new government of the Dominican Republic until they brought back Juan Bosch. Well, Johnson, and this one doesn't get talked about very much, he completely reversed that policy. He backed the military dictatorship against Juan Bosch trying to return to power. And he lied about it. He's spreading all these stories about all the atrocities that Juan Bosch's followers had started, including beheadings in hotels. Well, when Fulbright found out that Johnson had lied to him about all these things, that there were no such beheadings or atrocities or anything like that, this is when he began to tell his staffers, you know, Johnson lied about the Dominican Republic. Did he also lie about Vietnam? And so he set them to work on this. And guess what? They found out that he had lied about Vietnam, too, because Fulbright had actually helped pass the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, not realizing that Johnson was lying about this. And so when his staffers did their homework and they came back and they said, yeah, he did. This is what turned Fulbright against Johnson. And this is when he began to have these hearings in the Senate, okay, on the origins of the Vietnam War. And one of his staffers put together an essay and said, what Johnson has done is reversed the calculus of the political parties. You now have what used to be staunch Republicans supporting LBJ, and you now have what used to be backers of Kennedy violently against Johnson. So what he has done is split the Democratic Party. All right? And that is what he did. You know, that is what happened. And, you know, I believe, and most historians will agree with me on this, okay, the Democratic Party never recovered from that 1968 debacle. And Humphrey, for whatever reason, delayed his announcement of having a truce in Vietnam out of his loyalty to Johnson. You know how bad it got? Very few people know this. And in fact, I didn't know it, okay, until just a couple years ago. It got so bad that the Bundy brothers, McGeorge Bundy and Bill Bundy, began to try and convince Humphrey to come out against the war. I don't know how, you know, people listening to this show, how astonishing that is, because Bill Bundy wrote the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. So here you have Bill Bundy and McGeorge Bundy, who, by the way, Kennedy went around for his withdrawal plan because he knew McGeorge Bundy was too hawkish. All right. Here you have these two guys who backed the Vietnam War, now realizing that Johnson has gone so overboard that the Democratic Party was at risk, and they're trying to convince Humphrey to come out against the war. This is how bad it was. That's how bad things got. And so what I'm saying is, what we're seeing today is, and I think this is what Joe meant when he posted that article, is that this is what has happened, you know, to the Democratic Party. You know, it never really recovered from either the assassinations of the 60s or 1968, you know, the debacle of 1968. Because if you recall, and you do, it wasn't just a Tet Offensive, all right? It wasn't just, you know, the debacle that Vietnam had become. It was also the murders of King and RFK. And I think most people would realize that whatever hope there was to get out of this thing, you know, was killed at the Ambassador Hotel in June of 1968, because Bobby Kennedy at that time was the last great hope, you know, for his brother's legacy. Once King was gone, you know, and by the way, King was waiting for Bobby Kennedy to enter the race. His advisors wanted him to back McCarthy because McCarthy was the first guy to declare. Okay. And McCarthy was very successful in the New Hampshire primary. He did very well against Johnson. He only lost by, I think, 7 points, you know. And he said, why don't we back McCarthy? He's an anti-war guy. He goes, no. King says, no, I want to see what Bobby's going to do. And he was overjoyed when Bobby got into the race. Of course, that was very short-lived, you know, because he died in early April, and then Bobby Kennedy was killed 2 months later. And that was it for the 60s, you know. And Johnson just had too much control over Humphrey, you know, and Humphrey, even with the advice of the Bundy brothers, didn't come out against the war until it was too late. And by the way, let me close this out with this one point. Humphrey, in 1965, wrote a memo to Johnson. And remember, this is, I think, 65 or 66. This is the beginning of the escalations, okay? I think by the end of 65, if I remember correctly, Johnson had 170,000 combat troops, you know, in Vietnam. Remember, when Kennedy was killed, there were none. All right. But he had about 170,000 combat troops by the end of 1965. At that time, Humphrey wrote a memo to Johnson saying words of the effect, "Is it really wise to invest this much blood and treasure in Vietnam at this time? You know, is it really necessary for America's national security?" When Johnson got that memo, he froze Humphrey out of everything. He was off the invitation list for all the meetings about Vietnam. Okay? And so Humphrey, the only way he could get back in is if he took it back. And, you know, Johnson was famous for this. He loved to humiliate people. Okay? And so that's what he had Humphrey do. He had Humphrey take it back and apologize. And this is what turned Humphrey around on Vietnam. He really, his natural inclination, you know, was not to be a hawk, you know, but this is what Johnson did to him, all right? And so this was, I believe, you know, this was essentially a huge turning point. 1968 was a huge turning point in history from which I don't believe the Democratic Party has ever recovered. You know, and I think the latest result was exhibited yesterday, and also as a result of Joe Biden's foreign policy. All right. Okay, now, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, just to add to that, maybe a congratulations that I read on the Babylon Bee that this is Trump's third victory in a row.
What do you mean his third victory in a row?
His third election victory in a row. I thought you'd catch that.
Oh, you mean because they think he won?
Yeah.
In 2020?
Yeah, that's why.
Okay. I won't go that far. I mean,
I know. He had
his own Department of Justice telling him that this was all a bunch of baloney. I mean, Bill Barr. Okay,
no,
and
look,
then
look,
he forced these guys.
I meant it as a joke.
Okay, fine.
Kind of funny, yeah.
All right, fine.
His third straight victory.
Okay.
All right. So let's
get
to JFK.
Let's get to my letters. Joe Aquino. I'm so sorry, Joe, but he wrote me this letter like 2 months ago, but I haven't been on in such a while, and also I had to look this up. Why are Oswald's tax returns still classified? That's a very good question. I had to do some research on this. This stems back to the ARB. The only way the ARB could have gotten Oswald's, all of his tax returns declassified was if Marina Oswald approved it. Because the IRS has a policy that they will not declassify any tax return unless the person agrees to it, or if he dies, if his next of kin approves it. All right? Now, from my understanding, Marina Oswald was in cahoots with the LaFontaines, Ray and Mary LaFontaine, who wrote that book, If Oswald Talked. She told the ARB that she would not give any permission unless they declassified some other things that the LaFontaines wanted declassified. All right. That's my information. Now, from my understanding, as a result of the ARB, okay, and Marina relented a little, okay, you can see the 1956, 1958, 1959, and 1962 tax returns. I actually found those online through a search. Okay. Now, that, of course, is not all of his tax returns, but that's at least some of them. All right. So very good question, Joe. And that is, to the best of my ability, my answer to that question. Like I said, I had to do some work on that. I don't mind doing the extra work. All right. Okay, now, September the 11th, Mike Jacobs. I want to share my thoughts with you and Len about the prospects of getting the remaining JFK documents released. First of all, I think we can dismiss Trump's recent promise as BS that if reelected, he will release all the JFK documents. He says a lot of things that either changes his mind or denies he ever made the statement in the first place. He already had an opportunity while in office to release the documents, then change his mind, or more accurately, had his mind changed for him. Trump isn't someone that anyone in the JFK research committee should sympathize with or even support. For one, his coup attempt on January the 6th, which involved white supremacists and anti-government right-wing militia groups, he courted for years, should disqualify him from ever being president. He should already be behind bars. These are the same groups JFK fought against, as you have documented. All right, let me just comment on that. I believe that Joe Biden's worst appointment was Merrick Garland as Attorney General. I believe his best appointment, on the contrary, was Lina Khan at, I think it's the, the SEC. She's really good. Okay. Merrick Garland, I believe, was the worst. Now, why do I say that? If you recall, Merrick Garland spent like 2 years going after these little guys involved in the insurrection, the low-level guys. And it wasn't until just a couple years ago that Jack Smith was appointed as special prosecutor. Look, anybody who watched that thing, all right, anybody who saw the Trump and Giuliani speeches, okay, at the Ellipse that day, and we wrote an article about this at Kenny's and King, would have realized that this was an organized action in which Trump had a role. And because of the committee, the House committee, who did an investigation of this, we know that that's what happened, that Trump rejected the advice of, for example, Pat Cipollone, and who was the White House counsel, of Bill Barr, of all the top-level Justice Department officials. And he decided to listen to Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, and let's not forget the pillow man, Mike Lindell. And Cipollone testified about this. He said he had left that day. This was before Trump sent out that message to the Proud Boys, okay? And he left the White House because he thought this was all done. But then he heard, as he was leaving, that Trump was having another meeting that night. He couldn't believe it. Okay? So he walks back to the Oval Office, and he sees that Trump is there with Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and Lindell. And from his testimony, they literally got into a shouting match. Okay? You know, because he thought that these guys were leading Trump down, you know, down a horrendous path that was going to end up in violence, which it did. All right? Okay? And then he actually called Meadows, the chief of staff. He called him during the insurrection. And he said, look, you better get a good defense lawyer. because there's going to be blood on your hands when this is all over. All right. And so when I saw that Merrick Garland was doing this penny ante stuff, you know, and not going after the big fish, I said, this is a terrible mistake. I said that to myself. Okay. All right. Trump and his right-wing network of friends has no interest in JFK or his legacy anyway. All right, let me comment on that. I think it's very hard because Trump said this in front of 11 million people on the Joe Rogan show. I think it was actually more than that.
Oh, yeah, it was probably 11 million that one day.
Yeah, right. Okay, and so on top of that, this is one of the reasons that Bobby Kennedy decided to endorse him, okay, that he was going to let loose the last of these documents. So maybe that's true, and it probably is true, you know, that Trump really doesn't have very much interest in JFK or what JFK stood for. But there is some leverage now. At least we have some leverage on it. And let's not forget. Let us not forget, as bad as Trump was on this, and he was pretty bad, he first, you know, he was intimidated by Mike Pompeo, who came in and gave him the whole riot speech. You know, if you do this, there's this agent in Morocco who's going to be killed, and we're going to tell everybody it was you, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And he did a 6-month delay. Then he did a 3-year delay, which meant it passed into the next election, which meant it was Biden. All right. What Biden did was even worse. And if you don't believe me, look up Andrew Eiler's wonderful essay at Kennedy's and King. All right, I think it's something like how Biden, you know, polished off the JFK Act. What Biden did was worse than what Trump did, because what Biden was going to do was essentially negate the JFK Act. He was going to essentially go back to the whole Freedom of Information Act days. Joe, I'm talking to you as an Irish Democrat. The Freedom of Information Act is why we had to have the ARB. Don't you understand that? You got Bobby Kennedy's bust in your Oval Office. You got a portrait of JFK in your study. And you don't understand, you know, that this is one of the deepest, darkest secrets kept by the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and the State Department. That's why they don't want to give up these documents. All right? The Freedom of Information Act is not going to get us anywhere. Apparently, Biden didn't understand this. I mean, that's the best I can say for him. Because he was essentially going to go back to those days. He was going to give those guys a say. The whole triumph of the ARB is that they didn't have a say. Everything was always determined to be on the side of declassification, no matter what the FBI said about it, no matter what the CIA said about it. Everything was leaning towards declassification. And Andrew Eiler is going to make a speech on this at the Kappa conference, which, by the way, has now gone virtual, okay? He's going to make a speech on this, which I'm going to introduce, okay, in which he's uncovered these documents that are even more strongly towards the ARB having the last word on this. And they clinched the case that Biden is breaking the law, all right, with this whole so-called transparency plan. All right, so that's my little speech about that. As for getting the JFK documents released, we need to give up on the idea that any president will ever be able to act independently and do what is right by the American people. It isn't going to happen. And why should we believe the executive branch ever will, based on the cover-ups and lies of government, led investigations dating back to 60 years? I do think there's a chance to get them released through the courts. The provisions of the JFK Act, as you have reported on in detail, have been violated repeatedly, and on that basis, could we ever get a federal judge to rule in our favor? is it a case the Supreme Court would ever take up? I'm no legal scholar, but I'm inclined to believe this is the only hope we have. I would like to hear your thoughts on this and what solutions anyone in the legal community may be working on. Mike Jacobs from Omaha. All right. There is a case going on in the Northern District of California. All right, I think I talked about this before. Gary Aguilar and Tink Thompson are the defendants, all right? And it's called the Mary Farrell Foundation lawsuit. All right, and Larry Schnapp, who you've had on your show, haven't you?
Yeah, several times.
Yeah, okay. Larry Schnapp and Bill Simpich are the two attorneys of record on that case. Now, the Justice Department has been fighting this tooth and nail, all right? And remember, this is Biden's Justice Department, okay? They've been fighting it tooth and nail, and they just made a move for what is called summary judgment. Now, if you're not an attorney, what summary judgment means is getting the whole case thrown out, okay? And that's what they're trying to do now, all right, in this Mary Farrell Foundation lawsuit, all right? And so I'm giving you the latest details of what is happening in that particular case, all right? So that's where things stand legally at this time, all right? Do I think that this is going to be successful? I don't really know. I do know there's over 4,000 documents that are still being withheld, all right? And by the way, according to Jeff Morley, if those documents are declassified, they will lead to other documents that you could file on, okay, that are very imperative to the JFK case, all right? And part of it is George Joannidis. All right. Thank you for your question. All right. Alfred Goldberg, a prominent historian of U.S. military affairs who also shared moments as part of history, serving on the Warren Commission that probed the assassination of President Kennedy and compiling insider accounts from the Pentagon after September 11, 2001, died on September 3rd at his home in Falls Church. Get this, he was 105. Wow. Goldberg was the so-called official historian for the Warren Commission. And obviously, he didn't do a very good job. And if you take a look at some of the comments by people on this Washington Post obituary, you'll see that a lot of people actually believe that Goldberg took the secrets of how the CIA killed Kennedy to his grave. I also believe, what makes this even worse, if I remember correctly, I think Goldberg worked for Kennedy as part of his administration, and he was involved, I believe, in the famous U.S. Steel case, where Kennedy tried to arrange a halt in price increases and wage requests, and they went back on their word, and Kennedy essentially called in his brother, and they decided to start suing U.S. Steel and these other companies. And they did, and they were successful at getting getting U.S. Steel to stop, okay, the price increases. I'm pretty sure, in fact, let me look that up because I don't want to mislead anybody. I think Goldberg was involved in that. I think he might have been, let me put it that way, the Secretary of Labor at that time, all right?
Right. His first name, Arthur?
His first name was Alfred.
Alfred.
Okay. I might be wrong on that. Okay, so don't quote me on that, because it might be Arthur who was actually the actual Secretary of Labor. In fact, according to some sources, this guy was actually instrumental in actually writing the Warren Report. Of course, it was a cooperative effort, but he was really one of the guys who was actually working on the final draft of the Warren Report. All right, so...
Yeah, well, there was Arthur Goldberg, who was the Secretary of Labor from 1961 to...
Okay, 1962. So I'm wrong about that. Thanks for looking that up. I don't want to mislead anybody. Thanks for that, Lynn. Unlike other bodies, we correct our mistakes. Okay. All right. Last email. And this is from a guy named Richard Ormsby. Hello, Jim. I enjoy your work so very much. Although I live in Scotland, I have visited Dealey Plaza once and was thwarted last February due to flight cancellations because of weather. Question. I recently learned that the JFK official limo driver died only a couple of weeks before the Dallas trip in 1963. This set off alarm bells. If this is true, and if so, you know, why is it never spoken about? And what a neat way to get rid of a conspiratory driver, getting in a conspiratory driver. Many thanks. Keep up the good work. Well, it is true. The guy who you're referring to was a guy named Shipman. He was the limo driver at the time. I believed he passed away in September, okay, or it might have been a little bit later. And he died at
Camp David. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, Eisenhower.
At Camp David. He died at Camp David just a couple of, I don't know if it was a couple of weeks or a couple of months, okay, but he passed away right at Camp David. All right, and I believe Vince, you know, who Palomera, the foremost guy in the Secret Service, I believe he said there was no formal autopsy made. So anyway, this is true, and this is how Greer ended up being the driver on the Dallas trip. And I don't think we have to go through all the problems that we had with Mr. Greer, okay, on his performance that day in Dallas. So, yeah, you're absolutely correct, and Richard, and thank you for the question. All right, what I want to wrap up now with is a new article that we have up at Kennedy's and King, and this is about the whole controversy about Oswald's so-called escape from the Texas School Book Depository. You know, the Warren Commission called this an escape. John Washburn from across the pond has written a two-part article for us, and it's about the very controversial evidence about what happened directly after Kennedy's assassination with Lee Harvey Oswald. Because the official story, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, is that Oswald left this book depository thinking there wasn't going to be any more work that day, which he was correct on. And the official story has him going to the bus terminal to get a bus, all right, getting off the bus, and then giving up his taxi cab to a little old lady. And the little old lady was nice enough to say, no, young man, go ahead. Gets on the taxi cab and takes him to within a few blocks of his Beckley Street apartment, and that's how he got home, all right? And the Warren Commission termed this an escape. Well, here's my question. What kind of a criminal escapes using public transportation and then offers to give up his taxi cab to a little old lady? What kind of escape is that? And to complicate that, as John Washburn notes, we have the testimony of Roger Craig. Okay, Roger Craig said that he saw Oswald descending from across the street to Texas Book Depository and getting into a Rambler and taking off with what appeared to him to be a dark-complected guy from Dealey Plaza. Oh, he ran after them, but he couldn't catch up. So what John has done is pointed up all the problems with this story. And Mary Bledsoe was a former landlady of Oswald's for just a few days. And in October of 1963, And she happened to be on that bus, all right? And she became one of the prime witnesses to place Kim on that bus. They needed her because the other witnesses, namely Roy Milton Jones and the driver McWaters, could not identify Oswald. They couldn't identify him. And the FBI report that he puts in here specifically says that, all right? He did not have a good view of this man at any time and could not positively identify him as being identical with Lee Harvey Oswald. He said he was inclined to think it might have been Oswald only because the bus driver told him so. Well, then if you have the bus driver saying that no, that's Cecil McWaters, in March of 1964, he withdrew his identification of Oswald as being the guy on the bus, and that he actually said that he confused him with Jones. And in this article, I don't know how he did it, but he dug up a picture of Roy Milton Jones. And I have to admit that he does look like Oswald, all right? And so then, of course, we get to the whole thing about the cab driver, William Whaley. And William Whaley, of course, very famously said words to the effect that, look, I was kind of rehearsed for this identification with a lineup, all right? Any good defense attorney would be able to show some problems. And I think McWaters said the same thing, okay, because the lineups were so unreliable that the Dallas police put together, all right? So this is a very interesting article about the so-called Oswald escape and how the Warren Commission, as they did time after time, tried to substitute very bad evidence and testimony as representing something that really was not what it appeared to be. And in fact, in any kind of trial kind of arrangement, all right, I don't think this testimony would have stood up. In fact, I'm pretty sure it wouldn't have stood up. See, and again, this is something that I think everybody who studies this case understands. You know, the whole basis of the legal system we have in the United States, all right, is the so-called adversarial system in which you have a judge, you have a defense attorney, you have a prosecuting attorney, and you have a jury, all right? And the defense attorney is supposed to represent the interests of the defendant, okay? The prosecutor is supposed to represent the interests of the state. The judge is supposed to make legal decisions about what's admissible evidence and what is not, and what is part of admissible testimony, okay, and what is not. See, this never happened in this case. And this is why you have all these problems with these very questionable witnesses. All right. Now, a problem with Whaley, and he was a cab driver, all right, is that the official timeline says that he was supposed to have picked up Oswald at 12:48 by cab from the Greyhound bus station. All right. But yet, his manifest shows that he picked somebody at 12:30. And dropped them off at the 700 block of North Beckley. All right? Now, the Warren Commission tried to cover this up and said that he was really rounding off 15 minutes, okay? But if you take a look at the manifest, this is not really true, okay? Because it didn't happen in these other instances on his manifest, And if you round it off by 15 minutes, it still wouldn't be 1248. It'd be 1245. Okay? So this article goes through all of these problems, and it brings into very serious question, you know, if this was the way that Oswald got back, you know, to his apartment house. And it leaves open, and I've always believed that this was a strong possibility, it leaves open the possibility that Roger Craig was correct, you know. And if you believe Roger Craig, okay, and I believe he was a good witness, you know, then there just might have been two Oswalds there in Dealey Plaza. Okay. All right. And in the second, actually, this will be the third part, because these are two parts. I think that John is going to go ahead and advance that thesis. All right. Okay, Lynn.
Very good.
Thank you so much.
All right. And thank you. And we'll keep in touch. And leave it at that for now.
Okay.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.